5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, flowing.
Welcome to AnnaZone 23, where we look at old anime, especially movies and OVAs. These are the films and projects that help shape the anime landscape as we know it today. We want to look at them in their own era and how they were the inspiration for many of the shows and franchises that are popular today. Some have become legends, while others have been deservedly forgotten. All of them, you should remind yourself, someone had to draw that.
Thanks, Major Tom.
Hello, and welcome to AnnaZone 23, and on today's episode, we are talking about Crusher Joe, the 1983 co-production of Studio Neue and Sunrise. This is an anime film, and I just want to start off with, this film is good, but it is a butt-numbing 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Correction. It is the shortest 2 hour and 10 minute anime film you will see. Because we've compared My Youth in Arcadia to Crusher Joe. Both clock in almost exactly the same amount of time. My Youth in Arcadia feels like 3 hours. Crusher Joe is long because it has a lot of plots, but it moves a lot faster than My Youth in Arcadia.
Well, My Youth in Arcadia, it did feel longer. It felt longer than 3 hours because this felt like 3 hours. I enjoyed it the whole way through.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is as long as Odin.
But except maybe Birth.
Odin is unnecessarily long, and Birth is death, and you know that.
Yes.
But what I noticed when I was watching this is it's... First off, I want to get off... So we're very familiar in the West with three-act structures for films, especially animated films. Crusher Joe is not a three-act structure. It is more of a five-act play. Except I think I counted, like, three-act twos.
It's a three-act structure. They just keep redoing the middle plot. It's like, it's a one damn thing after another plot. It just keeps going on and on and on and on and on.
And I was discussing this with my wife a little bit. We were wondering, is at some point in the planning, was this maybe not planned to be a movie? At some point early on in the planning stages? Because it almost has the feeling about every 30 minutes, there's kind of like a stinger. And you could almost see it being, like, you could easily take this movie and cut it up into, like, a 5-episode miniseries.
Yeah, quite easily. It might also, I haven't read enough of Takachiho's actual short novels, but that might also be a factor of just how he writes. I get the impression that he is not the world's greatest writer. He's one of the world's more exciting writers.
Yeah.
So he may just have punched it out. Now, the one thing that, other thing that we like to bring up about Crusher Joe is Crusher Joe is both an accumulation and the father of more tertiary bits of pop culture than we could possibly name. But we're going to try to name most of them.
We like to talk a lot on our podcast about gatekeepers and through points. And this is one of those sort of, I guess, way terminals, you could also call it. Where it's there's a lot of paths that branch off from this one spot.
And there's a lot of things that go into this one.
There's a lot of things that go into this as well. So Crusher Joe, just to give a little bit of background, actually is a sci-fi novel series. Started in 1977, and actually the last one was published in 2016. Over 13 books in the total series.
I've heard rumors that there's another Dirty Pair one coming.
It would not surprise me. Do you want to give a little bit of background on the writer? That you have?
The writer is Haruki Takachiho. He was a known Japanese sci-fi writer. You may know from the date that he wrote Crusher Joe, there's a story going around about this. I don't have the full bit because I've never met him at a convention or anything, and I don't think Torrin Smith ever brought it up directly. But the story goes, as you can tell from 1977. Now, there's a pretty famous movie came out right about then. Something that offered a lot of hope about, you know, galactic empires and all that. Well, he was starstruck, so to speak. He was like, I want to write a story like that. And he looked around in Japanese sci-fi, and he noticed that Japanese sci-fi was very academic at that point. Lots of hard sci-fi. Lots of political stuff, but the true core of Japanese sci-fi was trying pretty desperately to be literary. So he decided, well, and historically, Japanese doesn't have... Space opera is more a mention of Japanese film than Japanese writing. Japanese sci-fi did not have a 30s golden age. They inherited America's 30s and 40s golden age post-war. So you get a little weird thing. So anyway, Mr. Takachiyo just said, well, fine, I'll write it anyway. And he supposedly wrote it in like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Given what I've seen of his writing, I could believe it. But he wrote a story about Joe, who was a crusher. He's like a private fix-it man contractor and general hero for hire in the sort of Han Solo mode, and his team who go to rescue a princess on a planet. Now, he did do a few things differently. For instance, his princess joins the team at the end of the novel. So this thing has the original story... Rescue on Planet, I don't remember what the name of it is, has Star Wars fingerprints all over it. And it was really successful. And he wrote several others. Also, Crusher Joe. Joe is the third main Joe that we have run into. We've run into in anime in the early history. He's also notable as he's the first Joe that actually survives his series. The other two being Ashtano Joe and Joe the Condor from Gatchaman. Also, Jason, if you're really American, and I don't remember what his name was in Eagle Riders, because I never watched Eagle Riders.
That's what I actually grew up watching, was Eagle Riders.
Oh, what was his name in Eagle Riders?
I don't remember.
Oh, see?
I remember watching it, but the problem is since I watched it as a small child, I have since watched... I watched Eagle Riders when it aired on, I believe it was on Cartoon Network, and then what was really bizarre is that when they came up with Boomerang, they started airing Battle of the Planets instead of Eagle Riders, despite the fact that they had already aired Eagle Riders on the main channel.
I think they had more episodes of Battle of the
Planets. Oh, yeah, I think Eagle Riders was only like 13 episodes or something like that.
But anyway, and the Crusher part, we're not 100% sure, but given some of the later things Takachiyo did, he probably took it from professional wrestling. There is a women's tag team called the Crushers that starred the original Linus Asuka. So we're thinking that's probably where he got it from.
Yeah, because I doubt he ever got to see the Crusher, who was active in the AWA in the 60s, 70s, and then the WWF in the early 80s, who often teamed with Dick the Bruiser. But the guy never had a Japanese career, unlike a lot of other wrestlers from the 70s who at least did a tour in Japan.
But Crusher is easy to say in Japanese.
Crusher's easy to say.
There are a few things we know about Takachiyo, although he hasn't really done any American tours. Obviously, bit of a sci-fi fan, bit of a pro wrestling fan, especially women's pro wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
The other two, he's famous for one other creation, which we'll get to a little bit later, and he's famous for founding Studio Nue, which was an actual independent design studio that basically designed mecha. And it did mecha designs for Yamato, it did mecha designs most famously for Macross.
Yes.
Which is why its headquarters is destroyed in the first episode of Macross.
So moving on to the movie, the primary driving force other than Takashiya with the movie is we have our kind of our driving designers for the film, which is mentioning Studio Nue. Mechanical design is Shoji Kawamori. Kawamori is best known for his work with, as just mentioned, Macross. He's also who did the mechanical design for Gundam 83, Stardust Memory, and then
Top Gundam.
And then many. Like he kind of is responsible for the look of 80s space anime.
If you see a robot that turns into a jet, it's probably
Kawamori.
Kawamori. Now the interesting. We'll get back on this in a little, just a minute. But when they got up the money, which was post-Macross the TV show, but pre-Macross the movie, they put in charge of directing and character design Yasuhiko Yoshikazu, or who we are going to call from now on Yaz, because I can say Yasuhiko Yoshikazu several times fast, but I'm not sure Rick can, and
nope,
I don't like to try to remember it. Now, Yaz is famous for a couple things. One, he did all the book illustrations for Takachiyo's books. So he was already familiar with the characters. Two, and what he's much more famous for, he's the character designer for almost everything Gundam up until maybe G Gundam?
I think he's the character designer for basically... He's character designer for Gundam, Zeta, and I believe double Zeta. And then I think obviously, Char's Counterattack is going to be him as well, because it's a continuation of the Gundam storyline. But War in the Pocket, I think that's also a Yaz character design. I don't know.
It's after his style, if it's not his
design. Yeah, if it's not him directly, it's inspired by his look, because all of that takes place within the same time frame. But I don't know if Double 83 kind of deviates from it. And then by the time you get to the 90s stuff, they're on different character designers, because it's going along with the 90s design. Because Yaz, even when he's done stuff that is more recent, it's still in his signature style. I mean, we just had Gundam the Origin wrap up about a year ago.
Gundam the Origin is very much in Yaz's style. He did the original manga that they're basing Gundam the Origin off of as a side project over a number of years.
If you've never read Gundam the Origin or seen the OVA series, it's basically Yaz does the manga is Yaz does the original Gundam. The OVA is Yaz does the lead up to the original Gundam. So it's like they called it a Gundam prequel, but there's some stuff that's changed that doesn't line up fully with the existing Gundam hit canon.
Yaz also did Giant Gorg and a number of other famous 80s shows. He worked with Tamino a lot, and he's often seen as the moderating effect on Tamino. When Tamino is working with Yaz, he doesn't kill all his characters, he just kills half of them.
It's kind of a case with Yaz. He's one of the more, like, there's kind of two schools of anime, if you ask me. If you have kind of, like, if it's an 80s anime, and your main character is a fairly good-looking young male, like, young adult male, you know, kind of stoic-looking, it's probably Yaz. Especially if he has really ugly side characters.
Yes. Yaz's main characters tend to be quite pretty. His side characters tend to get very cartoony.
Extremely cartoony. Although he's only got a handful of them.
Yes, and they're like Tezuka. He has a supporting cast. The characters keep cycling through. I mean, there are a lot of Amaro Ray clones. Before there were Ray clones, there were Amaro Ray clones.
Yeah. a good example, actually, is with this movie we're talking about today, Crusher Joe. And we'll get into this more when we do our, I'm going to call it the Gundam Omnibus. The Gundam Roundtable. That's going to be a big show, because it's going to be, there's a lot to unpack there. Mm-hmm. So the original, the antagonists of the original Gundam, the Zabi family, most of the Zabis show up as antagonists in Crusher Joe. Like, not the characters themselves, but the character designs. You at least see the head of the Zabi family, you see Dozel as a drooling moron.
Yes, even dumber than the original.
Even dumber than Dozel.
Dozel has dimensions, this guy doesn't.
No, he is... I can't even call him two-dimensional, because that's giving him too much credit.
Yeah, but yeah, you have the femme fatale, you have the big dumb lummox, you have the sneaky older guy behind the scenes. Yaz has a certain set of stories, and this is the first of three movies that he would direct. He did this one, he did Arion, and he did Venus Wars.
Yes.
And I think he did some of Gundam the Origin much, 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 much later. But he also did some side comics in between. So this show, because of the Yaz factor and because of the design thing, this is not only is it a Star Wars riff because it's very space opera-ish, this is about the absolute closest that Macross and Gundam ever got together as far as staff goes.
It's the closest you get to Gundam until 83 at least. Because that has the mechanical design by Shoji Kamimura, and I think he might have done more.
This is the more personal Gundam and Robot.
Yeah, this is more personal, because 83, it definitely tries to have some Macross elements in it, but again, that's for the roundtable. Yeah, that's a different show.
Yes.
There's a third entity to talk about in this.
Oh.
And it's a very important entity, especially in the world of sci-fi anime, and especially mech anime. And that's Studio Sunrise.
That's true.
Because Studio Sunrise is basically responsible for about most of the mech shows that you saw starting from about 1980 through about, probably 2005. It was probably a Sunrise production.
Yes. And on the mech show thing, there's one other thing to add. This show, between this show and Robotech, but this show is the hidden ancestor of the hidden Battletech battle mechs. A lot of them were Destroids in Macross. A couple were from Panzerworld Galliant, I believe. But all the other ones show up in this one. And since Studio Neue designed most of the other ones, except for the Panzerworld ones, you're going to see Locusts and Panther-class dropships and fighters. There, if you're an old-school Battletech fan, a lot is going to look very familiar because this is where they got it
now,
from.
Battletech is what went on to become the Mech Warrior series,
yes.
Right? For those of you that are maybe a little bit younger than that or not as
Mech Warrior has always been their computer name.
Yeah, with tabletop, Battletech and Mech Warrior are basically synonymous.
Yes.
It just depends on what product are you looking at. Are you looking at the game, or are you looking at the... I almost wonder if there was some kind of other... There was some other game called Battletech that was like a some long-lost piece of PC media.
I think they just did it to differentiate the board game from some of the computer games. Because the computer games have always been Mech Warrior, but they're always said to be in the Battletech universe. And the role-playing game is always Mech Warrior.
Okay.
So, Battletech was always the game... Originally, I think it was Battle Droids, but then they figured out that George Lucas would sue them into a hole before before Carl Masek and company sued them into a hole. But again, all these shows kind of jumping together. So Crusher Joe is a very basic, pulpy show. We have our team of adventurers.
They're kind of interesting because they're not... It's one of the first ones in a chronological. I mean, I saw a bunch of anime before Crusher Joe, but in terms of the shows that I've seen, taking them in their chronological order they appeared, it's one of the earliest anti-hero team shows. Like, kind of more, like when I say anti-hero, I mean not like the modern anti-hero that we're used to, like Punishers or things like that. More like Han Solo types.
Yes. I think, well, again, it's the Star Wars connection.
Yeah.
I always think of Crusher Joe... which we have a core team. We have Joe, the leader, who's a hot-headed kid, maybe 19 or 20 years old.
He's 19, because he specifically says so in the film.
He's 19. We have Talos, who used to be his father's partner, who is an enormous guy who's about 80% cybernized now.
He's a cyborg, big dude, and he's 52.
Yeah.
I've got the birth years here.
He used to be his father's partner, because Crusher Dan... was a famous Crusher before Crusher Joe. So we have those two. We have Alphen, the aforementioned princess, whose job is to lose her temper, be pretty, flirt with Joe, scream, and occasionally be competent.
And get drunk at the drop of alcohol.
Yeah, oh yes, and yeah, she's fun at parties. And then we have Alphen, who's like a tag-along juvenile delinquent kid, who's about, what, 15?
So the ages of the Crushers, because they actually have it all listed on the internet. Joe is 19, Alphen is 17, Talos is 52, and Ricky is 15.
Now, you may be thinking...
He's also the ship's engineer.
Yeah, Ricky's the engineer, Talos is the pilot, if I remember right.
He's the pilot, he's like the co-pilot and the muscle.
Yes, but if you actually are thinking about it, the easiest way to think of the Crusher Joe team is it's a Sentai team, but the guy who wants to be in charge and can't be because he's not really the hero is the guy in charge.
Yeah, it's kind of like
Talos is the big guy, Ricky's the comic relief, Alphen's the chick, and Joe's the Lancer.
Yeah,
this is what happens when the Lancer runs the show. That is essentially how Crusher Joe works.
There's a lot of shit goes sideways.
Yes.
like I said, there's kind of in the film, there's like three act twos, and all of them are because someone didn't think, probably Joe, didn't think the plan through all the way.
Or they get shot down in some mysterious
way.
They get shot down, they get chased, they get captured, they get escaped, they get captured.
There is a fifth member of the team, though.
There's that robot, which
Dongo.
Dongo, who looks frighteningly like Herbie, the Fantastic Four's robot.
It also looks a little bit like Seven's Arc 7.
Yes, which came out about the same time. But Herbie is a lot older. And,
yeah.
And the Fantastic Four cartoon was out a few years before that. So there's some chance that they stole him from the Fantastic
Four.
I'm not entirely sure on that.
He's got one of my favorite moments in this film, by the way. And it's near the climax. when they have the Minerva offshore. Mm-hmm. And then he launches the signature Kawamori missile shot.
Yeah.
He's, especially in the English dub, he comes off as bored and you know, completely robotical, because he's a robot.
Mm-hmm.
But he's reading a porn magazine. The robot's reading a porn magazine, and he's just like, oh, right, I gotta do that. Push the button. And he launches a Macross-style missile strike.
As we said, this is a slightly weird show. But Crusher Joe, the first movie, is essentially the tale of the Crusher team is hired to move a very pretty, rather naked, female body in cold sleep across interplanetary distances for an important operation. Unfortunately, this is after there's been one chase scene already involving the body. This is where a lot of the extra padding comes in.
With a chase scene.
Yeah.
Not involving our main characters.
At all. Which is quite cool, but takes up a good 10 minutes of the movie. But they go into warp. They're suddenly in Star Trek The Motionless Picture. That's the first Star Trek movie, if you remember the warp scene. They're pretty much trapped in that. When they get out of that, they've lost their passenger.
Yeah, I noticed that. I was watching this, I'm like, this is the warp scene from Star Trek The Motionless Picture.
Yes, it is. It doesn't go on quite as long as The Motionless Picture, and they don't fire photon torpedoes. But it is essentially the same scene. Now, once they've discovered, first they've lost their passenger, then Joe's dad, who looks frighteningly like Charlton Heston playing Andrew Jackson in The Pirate, down to the double-breasted jacket, shows up and tells them that they're under suspension for not checking the job through Crusher Control first.
Yeah.
Then the crew does what any self-respecting space opera crew would do and goes out to a disco and gets drunk and starts a fight. A very large fight.
This scene, the disco demolition, as we call it,
yes,
has one of my favorite lines I've ever heard, and it's straight from the subtitle script,
mm-hmm.
and they use it in the dub, and it's Joe's drunk, and he's complaining about the fact that they were suspended because they didn't call in an emergency request, and he's like, it's like, that's why they're called emergencies. They emerge with urgency. And I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was the line or the delivery, but that had me on the floor rolling with laughter.
The fact that he's drunk off his ass by that point probably has something to do with it too. And
the English actor is doing it, just plays up the drunkenness, like he's slurring his speech and everything, and it's fantastic.
Yes. By the way, the disco demolition, aka the bar fight scene, is probably the most singularly Yaz bit of the entire movie, because it features a lot of secondary characters highly stylized and cartoony bits. If you remember some of the side bits in Gundam, this is the same stuff turned up well past 11.
Speaking actually of Gundam, because it's a Sunrise picture, this is the first scene where I believe you see the Gundam mascot Haro as a piece of flying debris during the fight. Because if you sit down and watch this film, keep your eyes open during fight scenes when debris, like just crap's flying everywhere, for a green ball flying through the air. If so, I froze the screen. It was Haro, because it's a green ball with four little half circles on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the four little circles were the ears and legs. It looks a little bit like Vincent from the Black Hole, truth be told.
A little bit.
Just a little bit. Doesn't have the hat. Vincent is Haro going to a Devo concert is what it is. But anyway, so they're escorted out of this bar fight by an old associate of Joe's dad, and set on the right path to find the Murphy Pirates, who are behind this whole mess. Meanwhile, they're pursued, and they head to the Murphy Pirates' den by a battleship commander who arrested them in the first place, and is convinced that they are up to no good, which they more or less are, but they're up to no good in the cause of good. And then we have basically a long series of set pieces. Alfin and Joe crash and get in a fight, and there's some incredible animation mixed in that fight.
Oh, yeah.
Ricky and Talos get captured, and Talos shows off just how freaking tough he is. Then, let's see, Joe and Alfin get to the top floor of the enemy base, find the passenger that they were looking for, just as naked as ever before, which leads to Alfin's famous line, "Give me that, you pervert!" Takes a lab coat off of one of the scientists and throws it over the patient. Then they climb into a helicopter and fall off the building.
The head scientist in that sequence, in the dub, has the goofiest German accent I've ever heard in a dub. It is like Fritz Freeling doing a German accent.
Oh dear.
Like his bug when Bugs Bunny does a German accent.
Ah.
It's like that.
Worst case of rhabditis I've ever seen.
Exactly. It is exactly that. And then, of course, the escape, he's like, help me get back. And then, of course, he gets shot to death by the pirates.
Of course.
Because the pirates are trigger happy as all get out. Yes.
So they flee off into the woods, pursued by locusts, if you're an old Battletech fan, who eventually get tripped and fall. Then we get Alfin, Joe, and the hostage out in the woods for a little while, so that Alfin can get jealous of Joe and kick him in the nuts.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Alfin pretty much joined the team so that she could hang around Joe. We are never told this, but we can infer this.
It's pretty inferable, especially by the ending scene.
Yes.
Of the film.
Yes. Duh. But, yeah, Alfin is weird because it's one of those, like, halfway between competent and damsel in distress characters where you can't really tell if the writer is just trying to give them all the action that the woman character would have.
It's kind of, it's trying to build a balance. Like, you can't tell if she's being a damsel in distress, or if she's being a damsel in distress because Joe will save her.
A little bit of that.
She's doing it deliberately.
It's hard to tell sometimes, but she has a scream that would honor Faye Ray, so we can't complain too much.
Both versions of her, which, by the way, Alfin in the dub is voiced by Juliet Cesaro, I think is her last name.
I think that's the name.
And she went on to be the original English voice actor for Belle Dandy from Oh My Goddess.
And then when ADV did their version of Oh My Goddess, she did Pale, the rival goddess.
Yes.
So she has one of the earliest and oldest acting careers for voice actors in anime. And also, Alfin is one of those strange cases in anime fandom. There is not a lot of merch for Alfin. Because
I found one statue.
There's a couple. But I've seen at least two, and there's a mini one floating around. There's a couple statues floating around, but anything that comes up Alfin is usually as expensive as heck, because anybody who's old enough to remember Alfin, and she does seem to have a core fan base, by this point has a lot of money, and they tend to charge through the roof. Alfin is one of those people you will never see a $30 figure for, but she has a couple of $150 figures, and you can count on one to two coming out every decade, even though Crusher Joe has not had a show since 1990.
Fun little fact, Juliet Cesaro also was Miyuki Kobayakawa.
In
You're Under Arrest.
Yes, the Yuri character.
Yes.
The essentially Yuri character. But we'll get to the Yuri. Oh, the other side bit that pops up in the middle of all this is the secret meeting with the president of the planet that the Murphy Pirates are more or less lording everything over, which is done in a space drive-in theater on multiple levels. It looks kind of like one of those golf shot places in Japan where they have, like, layers of golfers, except everybody's parked their cars to watch a movie.
The best way I can describe it is if anyone's ever been to Disney World or Disneyland and ridden the Soaring ride.
Mm.
So Soaring, the way it works is you climb into a seat, and then it lifts you out, and it's three tiers of seats pretending to be hang gliders in front of an Omnimax screen. So imagine, like, the big IMAX screen, but instead of stadium seating, the seating is all, like on the same depth from the screen, but vertical.
And it's a drive-in.
Yeah.
So everybody's in their cars.
So imagine if someone put a big screen next to a parking deck.
Yeah. It's really odd. But anyway, the movie that we see is important because it features Takachiho's more famous creation, their very first official animated appearance. There's one student film before this, but this is the first animated appearance of Dirty Pair. Yes, Takachiho also created the Dirty Pair. This was so popular for a 3-minute cameo that it helped get the Dirty Pair their TV series about 2.5 years later. But we'll get to Dirty Pair. Dirty Pair is going to get their own show because they are, if Crusher Joe touches a whole family of memes, Dirty Pair is a rather substantial bush all by itself.
Yeah.
So it really deserves its own discussion. But yes, Crusher Joe touches everything. Everything Dirty Pair springs out of Crusher Joe. So after multiple adventures, multiple close calls, more plot complications than we really want to go into.
We get to our third act, too.
The, you know, other death-defying bit. Our heroes, well, of course. Do they win? Of course they win. Do they arrest the pirates? Well, no, there's nothing much left of the pirates to arrest. But they do arrest the president of the planet.
Yes, they do.
And they punch the guy who put them out on this mission for being an asshole and not telling them that he was using them. But it's a long and it's a long wild ride.
Yeah, it's 2 hours and 15 minutes.
There's just all kinds of stuff going on in it. It's a wild ride. It's fun. It's really quite well animated. It's not Disney level anime. It's better better than contemporary Disney. In some ways, I'd say.
In some ways, not so much.
Some scenes are done on ones and are really amazing, and some you can kind of tell they cheaped out.
I'd say it's not as high as what we'd expect from like a Ghibli movie.
No, not Ghibli.
Of a similar vintage. Like for example, our first episode on Cagliostro. Cagliostro is way higher quality animation than this. Mm-hmm. It's not bad by any means. It's going to blow any 80s TV animation out of the water. That's
oh yes,
sure. Especially when it blows heavy metal
out of the water.
Yeah, it blows parts of heavy metal out of the water. Mm-hmm. Some parts of heavy metal are still really well done.
Yeah, but.
Even though it's mostly rotoscoped, the spaceman falling from orbit is still a pretty cool shot.
Okay, that's not the one people talk about. I was thinking like the Disco Demolition is kind of, between the robots thing with the porn magazine. That's almost like that one interval in heavy metal.
A little bit.
But anyhow, so that wraps up that show, and that was it for Crusher Joe for about 8 years. And at the end of the 90s, they streamlined. Not streamline. Sunrise threw together another pair of OVAs, probably piggybacking off the success of Dirty Pair, and set them out. And these are the Ice Hell Trap and Ultimate Weapon Ash.
Yes.
And I think at least Ice Hell Trap is based on one of Takachiho's stories. Ash may or may not be. Ice Hell Trap is basically trying to rescue political prisoners in a frozen asteroid that's in a decaying orbit, which of course has political intrigue and physical danger and all kinds of things. And these are about 30 or 40 minutes, and they're not...
Actually, it's 55 and 60 minutes.
They're that long.
Yep. The two of them combined are almost as long as the original movie.
They're both similar in design. They're a lot cleaner in art design, though. They don't have nearly as much Yaz in them that the original did, because they were not directed by Yaz. So they don't have his kind of squiggly.
No, they look marks. More like some example I saw when I looked at it is Alfin, for a good example. She looks more almost looks like she could have stepped out of a Takahashi animation.
They look very late. Yeah, it looks very Ranma.
Not Ranma, I was going to say more Yurusei Yatsura.
Yeah, some of the higher end.
Alfin almost looks like Lung with blonde hair. Almost.
She's got. It's much straighter.
Yeah, it's straighter. It's not as wavy. curled it.
I would say it actually almost looks more like Orange Road than anything else I can think of.
Yeah, Orange Road would be another good one. Or even it actually, it also could look a bit like...
It looks a bit more generic is what we're saying.
Yeah, because now I'm thinking about it, it also could almost look like Aiko as well.
Yeah, it's a more general anime style. It doesn't have any of Yaz's quirks left in it too much.
No, it doesn't.
Ice Hell Trap is a fairly good story. Ultimate Weapon Ash is probably the best of the as a story of all of the Crusher Joe's stories. If you watch it, you'll be thinking, hey, this looks a lot like Screamers. Well, it came out 5 years before Screamers, but truth be told, Screamers definitely was, and Ultimate Weapon Ash probably was, based on an old Philip K. Dick story called Second Form. So, we don't have an official thing saying that Ultimate Weapon Ash is Second Form, but it's very likely. It's a pretty standard it's not a standard sci-fi plot, but it's a known sci-fi plot. The old still awake ultimate death weapon and the problems that comes with that. Ultimate Weapon Ash is a little bit, it's not nearly as body horror as, say, Megazone 23 Part 2, but it's a bloody mess. There's a lot of bloodshed in that one.
Yeah, there's two kinds of, as my wife put it, there's two kinds of wounds in this. There's like, oh, that's just, it's just
flesh wound?
No, it's just like, oh, it's just a burn mark, and oh dear God, all of my tomato juice is spilling out.
Yeah. it doesn't, there's not a lot of, there's not a lot of survivable wounds in that one. The other thing about the OVAs, which are, as I said, both watchable, but one beware point for viewers, there's another peculiarity, and we believe this, we're going to blame this on Gunbuster, because they did it first, is that there are eye catches inserted for no particular reason, because this is a direct-to-video show.
Yeah.
And there's far too many for it to be a TV show anyway, where they'll show the Crusher Joe title emblem and go, Crush! Since Gunbuster did it 2 years before with Gunbuster, for no particular reason.
Yeah.
We're blaming Gainax for this.
Yep, I blame Gainax for that.
But we don't know why it was in there. This might have been a trend for like a year or two, because I can't think of any, but I can't think of any other shows that did it. These are the only two I can think of. But I just might be missing a show or two out of my viewing experience. It was one of those ideas, somebody said, you know, well, let's do that. And then somebody said, on second thought, let's not do that. After 1990, Crusher Joe kind of faded out, and nobody really had heard about it. It usually got brought up as a second taste if somebody got into Dirty Pair.
Well, it's kind of interesting with Crusher Joe, because I'm reading I read a little bit on the video releases. So, the first version released was Laserdisc in 1996.
Yeah. Anime.
That was anime. And then 4 years later, it was released on VHS in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2003, they had a combination release.
Mm-hmm.
The original film and the OVA, that was released in 2003 on DVD.
Yep. Which I have.
There was also a UK release under the name Crushers on VHS. I was not able to find when that was released.
That was before the anime.
But they did a for kids on it.
Mm-hmm.
They aimed it at kids, so they cut out the violence and the sexual preference.
They would have had to cut some of those scenes.
Here's another really bizarre thing. In 1994, FamilySoft released a Crusher Joe game for the PC 9800.
Okay, Japanese market.
Japanese market. But that's still really bizarre.
No, there was.
Well, with the novels continuing, I guess it wouldn't have been.
No, not really. You have to remember, this is as far as, you know, Blood and Thunder sci-fi novels in Japan. This was much more known in Japan. It's just that in American fandom, you generally heard about Crusher Joe through Dirty Pair, which mm-hmm. is, as we've shown, backwards. But that's the way it was. Now, I remember seeing some art coming out from Sunrise about some new shows in just after Ava came out, about 97 or so, and I was like, oh, are they redoing Crusher Joe? And I was wrong, but I was kind of right. Because remember we said Sunrise Show, remember we said cast of four wandering around on a spaceship, including an old grizzled guy with mechanical parts, Does this remind you of anything?
Could it be Cowboy Bebop?
Possibly.
Actually, fun story, when we were watching the dub of this, we're like, you know, you could take the main cast of Cowboy Bebop and cast them as the main cast of Crusher Joe, and it'd work pretty well.
Yeah.
The only one that would have to do a kind of a major... because they wouldn't be playing like they wouldn't be playing the same way they acted. Well, I guess Jet's voice actor would be
Jet and Talos are almost the same guy.
Yeah. Ricky,
can you see Talos doing bonsai trees though? Maybe.
Actually, I probably could.
Okay.
The biggest change would probably be Mai's voice actress, who was I'm blanking.
Ed.
I could see Ed's voice doing Ricky.
Well, she just have to play up the vampy damsel in distress mode a lot more than...
Well, she'd be Jill. Doing a different, I'm sorry, that pulled up, I was searching for the Cowboy Bebop character, and I somehow ended up with the My Valentine from...
Resident Evil?
No, My Valentine from Yu-Gi-Oh!
Oof. Yeah, you went down a dark corridor.
I use my phone to double check myself, as it's our mobile database room. We have to check crap.
Because
it's Faye Valentine, that's why. It's not Faye My Valentine.
Yeah, My Funny Valentine is so she's introduced it.
Yeah, that's why I get that. I totally could see Steve Bloom as Joe. Because it wouldn't be that different from some of the characters he play.
No.
Bo Billingsley, I could totally see that.
Yep.
Wendy Lee has played enough teenage.
Wendy Lee has played.
Wendy Lee has range.
Yeah, has range and has could definitely slide into Alphans, no problem whatsoever.
Same thing with Melissa Fawn. Melissa Fawn
could play, Ricky in a heartbeat.
Because Melissa Fawn, she's known for, let's see here, other than Edward. I'm trying to pick ones that we've.
Okay. While you're looking, I will point out, and I've said this at several conventions, and anybody in the know, nobody has ever contradicted me on this statement.
She was the Tachikomas.
The Tachikomas, that's it, okay. Now if you'll let me finish.
Go ahead.
Cowboy Bebop came about when Crusher Joe and Lupin the Third got drunk in the beanbag chair in Quentin Tarantino's den. That's what spawned Cowboy Bebop.
Yes.
And anybody who has any knowledge of old anime at all, nobody has ever contradicted me on that. They're just like, yep, that's pretty much it. And on top of this, there's a certain Sunrise Tech. The episode with the eco-terrorists, for instance, the elevators there, those are the same elevators that they used in the Dirty Pair TV series. A lot of the tech carries over from one from the other. And since Dirty Pair technically is in the same universe, just earlier than Crusher Joe, it's often stated that Cowboy Bebop is the prequel to both of them in an even earlier century. Now, we don't know if that's true or not. However, I have seen a picture that Yaz did that's floated around the internet that has Kay and Yuri from Dirty Pair playing with Faye Valentine's hair and costume.
Yeah, because considering Faye Valentine's costume is...
pretty much Yuri's
costume. Pretty much Yuri's, just with suspenders.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, she opens up firing the gun the exact same way, even. So Crusher Joe took in Star Wars and spat out Cowboy Bebop, which means that it also spat out bits of Firefly and 20 other... This is about as close as we get to the Han Solo of the series. Well, Outlaw Star might be closer to Han Solo of the series. But Crusher Joe is the notice point and the starting point for an awful lot of anime things. Yeah. And that's why we find it so fascinating, because so much of it... It's an interesting enough show. It's lots of fun, but... It's even more fun if you're fairly familiar with what came before and what came after, because you're always saying, hey, that came out of, that was that, and that was that. The other analogy we use for Crusher Joe is, Crusher Joe is to anime what The Rocketeer is to the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, we've so, For those of you who have never seen the Rocketeer, if you've seen Captain America, you've seen a lot of the major set pieces from Rocketeer. Rocketeer was a movie from 1993?
I think it was 91 even, but...
Let me check
myself. It's early 90s.
Let me check myself before I wreck myself. Give me 1 second. That's not English, Rick. Mm-hmm. The Rocketeer. So The Rocketeer was a movie made by Disney in 1991. You're right on that one. It was directed by Joe Johnston, who is best known for Captain America, the First Avenger.
Yep.
There are several... I wrote my final paper in my History of Animation course. Because we were talking about... They wanted to talk about special effects. And I talked about some of the major sequences between The Rocketeer and Captain America. And there was a couple sequences. For example, the ending sequence.
Yeah. One's on a Zeppelin, one's on a Death Bomber. They're not too terribly different.
Both of them are fighting Nazis.
Yeah, both fighting Nazis. You always are fighting Nazis. That's just sort of a given. But yes, it's kind of like the show where they learned how to do a lot of things, and then they did something that became much more famous.
Yeah, they use lessons.
The Rocketeer is like production. Is the director saying, "Yeah, I can do a period piece set in the 1930s, 1940s
with special effects."
With special effects, I can do a pulp adventure story. It's no problem. Look at this.
And then from pulp adventure story to comic book hero origin story.
Set in the pulp era.
Not a huge jump.
No. And there's not a huge jump between Crusher Joe and Cowboy Bebop. Cowboy Bebop has better plotting, better music.
They're not part of an organization.
They're not part of an organization. They are truly private contractors, and they're always broke.
Yeah.
But the general outline, and again, Jet has cybernetic replacements. Spike's a little bit hot-headed.
The biggest difference, I almost feel, is...
That, of course, makes the robot Juan, or Ein.
Yeah. Because the biggest difference would be Faye and Alphine are, like, opposite ends of the spectrum, kind of.
Faye has a lot more of Fujiko in her.
Yeah, she's got a lot more Fujiko in her. That's where the Lupin comes in.
Spike's
dress sense in general.
His dress sense in general, but his shoes especially. Those shoes are so Lupin, it's not
funny.
And
then Edward is just a weird character.
But it's kind of
Rocky is Rocky is Scrappy-Doo. I pretty much Ricky's, as soon as he... Oh, yeah, Ricky, really. Yeah, Ricky is Scrappy-Doo. Like he opened his mouth and I'm like, oh, you're Scrappy. Got it. I'm going to hate you.
He's definitely the let me at him type. You know, the guy who...
Very much. Especially,
he's about 110 pounds. He's like, I can take him.
Especially with the voice. The voice actor seemed to be channeling Scrappy when he was recording the dub.
You know who you would be channeling if you were doing Ricky nowadays?
Who?
Scout from Team Fortress.
Yeah, it'd be
down
Scout
to the Irish team. Accent.
Down to the Brooklyn Southie. Accent.
He'd do it as a Southie.
You think he'd do it as a Southie?
Yeah. But yeah. If you're looking for a modern version, if you just happen to manage to miss Scrappy-Doo, lucky you, Ricky's essentially the Scout from Team Fortress.
Yeah.
With a little less bad language. But other than that...
I don't know.
If they actually did him in English, he probably would.
He would have a foul mouth.
He would have a foul mouth. Yeah, it all kind of blends together. This is not Tale of the Tape. Crusher Joe has been back in print for the last couple of years.
Yeah,
it's actually reasonably available and only about $20-$25.
Yeah,
for the movie and OVA separately.
It's a new release. Yeah, it's not the combination release Animego did. It is separate releases. Another interesting thing I found out, starting in 2017, was the manga series, let me get back to it real quick, Crusher Joe Rebirth. It is a new manga series by the same guy, by Haruka Takachino, and I'm looking at the art, and the artist is Fujiko Hosono.
Doesn't ring a bell.
That was the artist of the original manga series.
Okay, the one that, which was briefly
was
brought
to
the U.S.
It ran for 1 year.
Yeah. There's one thing about Takachio's stuff, there's not a lot of manga connection to it. There's usually a manga adaption somewhere, but... It's a little bit
that's
here,
the first
there, and everywhere. Yeah,
it is from the art I've seen just browsing while checking this, it looks very much, it looks very similar in layout and design to the Origin manga that came out. That came out, I think that started coming out about 10 years ago now, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's well, been out for a while. For stuff Yaz has to do, well, stuff Yaz does it tends to be spread out over a long period because he doesn't have that much
time. And if you're a fan, especially, I would just recommend if you can find like online somewhere, Crusher Joe the Rebirth, at least take a look at it, because one thing that we talked about, and thankfully, watching some of the newer stuff, is that anime, thank God, is finally starting to diversify again in terms of art style. Mm. The last couple of years, we've talked about, in terms of art style, everyone looking the same. But now we've started to start, especially with things like Origin coming out, and because we've talked about this before, we were kind of worried that like if they did a new version of an older show, it's not going to have the same kind of look. Mm-hmm. But then stuff like Origin came out, which that looks like basically the original Gundam series if it was done with modern budget and modern production methods.
It looks so Yaz it hurts.
It looks so Yaz it hurts. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend also watching Megalobox, which looks like something straight out of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, to the point where they animated and shot it in 4K, and then they compressed it, and then remastered it, so it looks like a 1990s anime
to give that's it a been rough remastered. Edge. It looks, give it a little bit of rough edge. Other ones that kind of look a little bit throwbacky. Jitsuwa Watashiwa.
Jitsuwa Watashiwa, a little bit.
Has a definite flavor of 80s.
It's got more of a writing style. It still has some of the more modern. So the character design is a little bit more classic.
Yeah.
But it's not quite the same as this other stuff that I'm looking at.
No, it's not as overt, but it's definitely more of a throwback than your standard love comedy is.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited to see where we'll be going in the next few years. I'm going to be curious to see if any more are going to go down the Origin route. Even more modern references. We just went, my wife and I this past fall saw Promare.
Mm.
Or as we call it, throw everything good about Gainax and Trigger, throw it in a blender and hit the puree button. And then make it about firefighting. And you have 2 hours of absolute insanity, which I have not seen since, to be honest, Kill la Kill or Gurren Lagann. But it's interesting to see how we're starting to see some of these older styles, and I'd be really curious if Rebirth does well, will we get a new Crusher Joe?
That would be, I would say that we have better odds of getting a new Dirty Pair.
But here's the thing. Here's the other thing to think about. There probably is a better chance of Dirty Pair, but could you also see Crusher Joe showing up in a Dirty Pair show?
Or
Dirty Pair project?
What you could see. What I could see is, because one of the Crusher Joe stories is not a Crusher Joe story, it's a Crusher Dan story.
Oh, about Dad?
It's about the time that Talos and Crusher Dan teamed up with Kay and Yuri.
So what you're saying is when Crusher Joe happens, Kay and Yuri are old women.
Yes. There have been rumors and stories and everything back and forth, and nobody knows quite what the...
So what you do is you do a Dirty Pair time travel episode.
I think they've already done a Dirty Pair time travel episode. I think that's in the newest book. It's again, Crusher Joe is this. It's one of those things. It's famous for what went into it and what came out of it.
It'd just be interesting to see if we can go full circle again.
The only problem with bringing out Crusher Joe is that now it would look like a Cowboy Bebop riff.
It would look, it is one of those what's old is new, new and what is new is repeating.
Yeah, it's kind of, you're looking, it's like when you look at The Rocketeer and you're like, oh man, this looks like Captain America. It's like, it's the same director, dude. Of course it looks like Captain America. But, it's, again, perfectly worth watching. Lots of fun, a little long. OVAs, first one's okay. Second one's pretty damn good.
If you can only find one,
Do the movie.
The movie is definitely the most indicative of the property
and the most indicative of its era.
Yes,
it is Yaz cut loose on his own. It is right. It basically was between his Gundam work and Giant Gorg.
Yeah.
So it has Yaz in full flower doing all of his cartoony stuff.
There's lots of Looney Tunes slapstick in this, too.
Yeah. Yaz does that.
You know what we did not talk about?
What?
We did not talk about the villain's cat. That's not a cat, but a lumpy lizard thing.
The lumpy lizard thing? Yeah, which is... It's not much to see. Yeah.
It's like an ugly version of Pascal from Tangled.
Pretty much. It doesn't do much. Pascal does more.
Well, yeah, he does more. But, like, from a visual state, it's like we're watching it, and my wife and I are like, that thing is ugly and adorable at the same time.
Yeah, the villain doesn't have a white cat to stroke. He has something that looks like it looks like Pascal covered in rocks.
Looks like Pascal covered in tumors with giant eyes.
Yeah. it's weird.
It looks like he has a pair of ping pong balls on his face with just tiny dots for irises.
There's some weird things in this show.
And then I'm like, that's
a little terrifying.
There's a lot of most of the monsters that show up in the wilderness in this movie.
The other thing I was going to say is, the mecha are easier to find than the characters. The only character I've ever seen figures done for is Alfin.
Yeah, they've done...
Alfin has had several figures done of her over the years. Tend to be high-end now, because as I said, I think she was the first crush of more than a few early larval otaku
probably
in Japan. Because her stuff is always hideously overpriced, too. So, nobody has ever done a set or anything. The only thing I could hope for... is we still don't have a Blu-ray release.
No, still no Blu-ray release. Which would be very interesting, considering how colorful. The thing with Kawamori design mechanical stuff and Yaz character designs is they tend to pop quite a bit.
Yeah.
They both tend to be very colorful with their design work.
Yes. Especially, he's dialed his color down a little bit from Gundam, but it's still pretty poppy in this one. The other part I would say about that is, yeah, go buy, siege them, get those OVAs, buy the disc. If you do that enough, somebody will come out with the Blu-ray. If we're really lucky, Animego might get the rights back and do the Blu-ray release. And then we get all sorts of neat collectibles.
I mean, we got Riding Bean on Blu-ray coming.
Yeah, but he has like a connection to Sonoda, and he never lost the rights to that one.
That's true.
He gave up the rights to, his rights expired on Crusher Joe. That's why the other company brought it out. I'm amazed. The one thing I would really like to see is a Blu-ray Crusher Joe. Especially the movie. Especially the movie. That would look really cool. Crusher Joe is also proof that Star Wars hit Japan just as hard as it hit everybody else.
Yeah.
I think that Empire Strikes Back pretty much is what got it greenlit as a movie. Because it came out the same year as Return of the Jedi, just a little bit ahead of it.
This was released in March 83, and Jedi came out in May 83.
Mm-hmm. And of all the Takachiho ones, this is the most exciting that is not drowning in music.
Yeah, there's really not a whole lot. There's not a whole lot of music in this one.
Yeah. Well, as comparison to Project Aiden, which is almost a music video.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. But we'll get to that one when we get to Takachiho Part B.
Or as we like to call it, the Dirty Angels.
Dirty Angels. A lovely pair. That's Marvel's version of it, actually. There have been... Oh, geez. But yes. So, tune in next time when either we get four people in a room and talk about Gundam.
This has opened up a couple of different paths for us to go on for our next episode. We've got a Gundam show coming. It's just, there's a few friends of ours that know, between the two of us, I know far more about Gundam.
I will be the master of ceremonies for Gundam. I will be playing Rick. Rick will be playing me. And Rick will be standing next to two guys that make him look like me about Gundam. Seriously. And I am not totally ignorant of Gundam.
Expect that one to be multiple parts when it goes up.
That one, we are going to have to lock ourselves in a room with a couple of pizzas and several drinks. And I'm going to kill myself editing it. There's just no two ways about it.
And then some of the other ones that we're looking at is, as we said, Dirty Pair will be another one that we're going to do.
Dirty Pair is definitely on the track. Area 88, whenever we can draft Broden.
Whenever we can draft, one of our Gundam experts is also going to be our Area 88 guy.
And our other Gundam expert is our...
He's our
Mighty
hard,
Space Miners.
Yeah, he's our hard sci-fi guy.
And he'll do Mighty Space Miners with us, I'm sure.
And that one will be a tale of the tape.
Yeah, that is... Well, no, it's actually available.
Well, that's true. It is available.
It is available. It's tale of the tape for a weird reason.
It's tale of the tape for a very bizarre reason, which we'll get into. So, until next time, I've been Rick.
And I've been Drew.
And remember, someone had to draw that.